The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Jonathan Franzen's new novel is called Crossroads, and that title hits it pretty much on the nose. The story is about a Midwestern family at a pivotal moment in all of their lives. It takes place in 1971, which was another kind of crossroads for the entire nation. The utopian ambitions of the 60s seemed to have foundered. We were heading toward Watergate and what Jimmy Carter would later describe as a crisis of confidence. Crossroads is the first book of a projected trilogy. I spoke with Jonathan Franzen, and we began pretty much inevitably talking about the pandemic.
I was finishing Crossroads during the first 4 months of the pandemic, and I had an office I could still go to, and we did no socializing, so I could go to bed at 9 every night and get up at 5:30, which was fantastic for a writer. And more recently, you know, I haven't gotten COVID yet. That's really all I can say.
Well, is that ideal for a writer, that kind of, I mean, despite the tragedy of it all and taking that aside, which is hard, very, very hard to do, is that kind of solitude and lack of interruption ideal for you?
Yeah, it's perfect. So I try to keep quiet about that because I know, you know, the millions of people who are suffering, and I just go, la, la, la.
Well, let me ask you this. My understanding from talking to our mutual friend, Henry Finder, your editor and mine, is that sometimes in your writing life, the way it happens is you think and think and think, and that process can go on for a long time, and maybe you're doing other things, and then an idea kicks in, and then in the space of a relatively short period of time, a pretty ambitious novel emerges. Is that the way it's happened now with this new book, Crossroads?
It's a little different this time. I mean, I had a very ambitious project for a single volume novel with three parts set 25 years apart, each of them. And then when I started writing, I realized I had a whole lot to say about the 1971 portion of the novel. So it turned into a whole book. You know, maybe it would have been smart for me to say, and there will be a second book with two parts, but for whatever foolish reason, I decided to say, no, there are going to be two more books.
No, but just in terms of process, what you say is very interesting, that for years, you're
years.
Basically thinking.
Yeah, it's occasionally I will take a stab at writing some pages. But these books really are icebergs. There is this 90% below the surface, which is all about figuring out the characters.
Why at this point in your life, you're in your early 60s, why explore the question of faith at this point in your writing life? It's so central to this book.
For a person who's never been a believer, never had a religious experience worthy of the name, I've spent a lot of time thinking about religion. I was part of a church for 12 years as a kid. I explored that path again in my 30s when my life had fallen apart. seeing whether there might be something there, something to get me through a divorce, the illness of my father, the commercial failure of my second novel, and some other things. It didn't take. I went to some Catholic church services with a girl I was pursuing. But it didn't take, and yet between that upbringing, my engagement with writers like Dostoevsky and Flannery O'Connor, and frankly just a familiarity with the Bible and a sense that those were somehow, in spite of myself, foundational stories, and finding the message of the gospel, if you read it carefully and actually listen to what Jesus is saying, finding that not only did it make sense to me as a set of ethics, it is kind of the foundational ethics for much of Western culture. And we were seeing that when I was growing up in the leadership, the Christian leadership of the civil rights movement, the Christian leadership of the anti-war movement. So it's always been there, and it's been present. And it at this point in my life, as you say, I'm in my early 60s. I just turned 62. You start to look around for things you haven't gotten into yet.
So then set out what the ambition for the trilogy is, if you fully know it at this point.
In the course of doing some interviews for the book, I've realized that trilogy is maybe not the best word. It calls to mind The Lord of the Rings or something. Which is
books that you loved, by the way, if I remember right.
Oh my God, yes. No. Yeah. How many times have I read Tolkien?
Yeah.
Many, although none of those recently, but you could bind them all as a one ring to bind them all, one publisher to bind them all. you could bind them all in a single volume, and you wouldn't notice that you were in a new book, and that is not something available to me. I wrote Crossroads to be a freestanding book, and the other two need to be freestanding books. I do intend to have common characters, to take up many of the Hildebrands later in life, and also to take up their children, maybe in some cases even their grandchildren. That's what you get when you do a 50-year family story. But so I would prefer to think of them as a trio of novels that I'm attempting, with an overarching theme having to do with mythology, with irrational belief, which we're certainly still seeing plenty of in the present, and also with a single family kind of at the center. But how I'm going to pull that off, I don't know yet. And that's actually, painful as it is, that's the place I think I need to be. I think it's a good place for a writer to be, knowing nothing, needing a new idea. I jokingly said to someone a couple weeks ago, maybe the third of those volumes is going to be a 500-page single paragraph stream of consciousness. I've never done that, and I was saying it completely joking, and I realized, but hey, that might be interesting.
It'll take you back to your roots a little bit. Well, of the avant-garde. Jonathan, there's been a hell of a lot of discussion, especially in the last couple of years, 3 years, whatever it's been, and even longer than that, about who can write what, how a white writer can or cannot write about characters of color, men about women about men. And I wonder how you engage with that conversation. Can anybody write about anything and anybody, or are there limits to it?
Some years ago, I said something that I'm told was misinterpreted. I think with enough love, you can write about anything. But love is not something I take lightly. Love is something that implies deep familiarity, profound connection, and I think it's rather easy for me to write about fathers because I have love of a father always to draw on. It's easy for me to write about female characters generally, because I've experienced, beginning with my mother, very powerful love of my mother, and with that love, and part of love is a sense of shared self, an intense concern for what is really happening inside the other person's head. If you've had that experience, and love is demanding too, you are in fact required to understand what's happening in the other person's head. If you've had that, I think there should be no limit. But that experience of love is not, you don't have that with everyone, and you don't have that with all groups. So I would never in a million years attempt to do the point of view of a Navajo character. There are some Navajo characters in the book, but they are exclusively seen from the perspective of a white consciousness encountering them. I don't.
And you have a scene early in the novel, as I recall, about a kind of white do-gooder in confrontation right. with a black woman. And tell me about writing that kind of scene where this conversation fits in.
I think it's... I think in this country, white writers should be very, very careful about how they write about black characters. Even if you are being rigorous about sticking in a white point of view, you still have to make decisions about how the black characters come across. And I feel as if it's incumbent on the – obviously, it's incumbent not to traffic in racial stereotypes. But it's also important not to err in the other direction and out of a sense of guilt or deference, portray black characters only as noble and virtuous. And that becomes a conversation in the book. Russ Hildebrandt, the pastor, although completely deplorable in many ways, I think he does have genuine sensitivity about the limits to understanding someone else's culture. And he has fallen in love with a younger white parishioner who he's implacably pursuing, although it could cost him his job. And she is the clueless white lady. And for me, the solution to it was simply realistic that a white suburban church would have a Southside Chicago urban partner church, and that people from the suburbs would mm-hmm. be coming in and working there. That happened all the time in the 70s, at least. And the way I negotiated that was to give Russ something like a contemporary sensitivity about cultural divides, and then have him play off against somebody who didn't get it. Really, the effort there was to demonstrate that I'm not unaware of the problem, and that not by way of virtue signaling, but just to try to make the reader feel less uncomfortable. I don't want readers thinking about anything but the characters, and if they start thinking about the author has waded into this, then I've failed. So that's hard. A long answer to your question.
No, not at all. It's hard to have this conversation about a book that you've written, I've read, but it's just out, and therefore the listeners haven't read it, and they're not familiar with the terrain quite yet. But there's one thing I think it's fair to ask, even in advance of people having read this novel, is that your work has traveled a long road, stylistically. When you started out in your first couple of novels, they were coming out of a tradition, I don't know what you would call it loosely, but more avant-garde. And there was a very concerted change, certainly with the corrections and thereafter. And I'd argue even now it's still changing, and there are fewer moments of deliberately hyperconscious bravura descriptions, and yet the characters are shaped by language and language alone in the most vivid and profound ways. And I get the sense of a writer that is central to his project, this way of going about language. And I'd love to know how you think about that.
I do think about it. I think about it a lot. There were many projects in the corrections, but one of them was just to show what I could do linguistically. Bravura is a good word. And I still enjoy picking up that book and reading a few pages. I say, hey, I was pretty good in my 30s. But I bump on language that calls attention to itself. And beginning with Freedom, I wanted that not to happen. I wanted to get out of the way and to create the same kind of sentence-by-sentence reading experience where every sentence counts, every sentence is doing something, something strong ideally, but to do it more with more traditional means, I guess. And the traditional means are capturing in words something that a reader might recognize, and particularly animating sentences with thoughts. And if you're pursuing a thought, you actually don't need the bravura kind of vocabulary, spectacular metaphors, all of that stuff, because the thought itself is interesting. And I proceeded in Freedom and Purity to try to become more transparent. And then finally, with this book, where I threw away all of the kind of Pomo hijinks and the grand plot elements and focused on five fairly ordinary characters, certainly in an unexceptional middle-class world, I thought here I might finally, A, really be becoming invisible as a presence, as an authorial presence, and also, not coincidentally, finally writing the book that most clearly represents who I am. It's really only in the course of writing Crossroads that I have said to myself, what I am is a novelist of character and psychology, and I'm not of the avant-garde. I am not of the formalists, although formal things interest me intensely and are incredibly important. That it's not about formal experimentation, and it's certainly not about changing the world through my social commentary. So, yeah, I'm aware of it. I'm probably too self-aware as a writer. That's my elite college literature study background with all the theoretical reading I did. So I'm super aware. That's the story.
You said on an interview on French radio recently that you, and I didn't quite get this, so I want you to explain it if you would, that you don't write for the extremists. You write for human beings trying to make sense of things and make sense of what to do. Who are the extremists and why don't you write for them?
Who are the extremists? I didn't mean that in a denigrating way, first of all. It's just where I, when I'm imagining someone reading me, I would say somebody who is extremely political, who cannot entertain the idea of a flawed character, but has to sort of jump in with political judgment and condemn that character for the flaws. I might be primarily who I had in mind.
And is that a problem in modern reading, do you find?
Oh, it calls to mind an email from, a young man. I have a public email address, and somebody wrote to me, as the phrase goes, writing for a friend, asking for a friend. He said he had a friend, and I believe he said she, who told him not to read Freedom because it was a terrible book filled with objectification of women. And I wrote back and said, you know what, if you're going to hold the characters in literature to a political standard and find the characters not worthy of sympathy and the author not worthy of reading, you're going to have a very, very sad little list of books you can read, because that has always been, or for a couple of centuries, has been the project of the novelist, which is to render the full complexity of characters, and moral ambiguity is particularly in the 20th and 21st centuries, that has been. That's a central artistic principle. And there are people who are so angry and so political that they cannot tolerate the notion that a person can be both good and bad, and that some situations do not have a clear structure of this is right and this is wrong. I think that's the extremism I had in mind.
When you teach or lecture or meet readers, do you see this as an increasingly dominant strain, that people want characters that either, I don't know, justify them or carry certain political banners in a way that's distorting to reading?
You know, a couple of years ago, you were kind enough to publish a short piece called What If We Stop Pretending that I wrote about climate change. And there was, you know, friends with long faces or who sounded like they had long faces in their emails to me said, oh, my God, that was very brave of you. You're the most hated person in environmental circles in the world. And how can you stand to write a piece that gets just slaughtered like that?
Just to be clear, you got this negative reaction because you were seen to some degree as fatalistic. Is that right?
In my view, I was being realistic
about
the likelihood that we will solve the problem of climate change, which strikes me as zero likelihood for good reasons. And the data is there for anyone to look at if they care to. So that was not received well in professional circles, particularly on social media. And it was really weird to hear from these concerned friends, because the response I got was overwhelming, and it was 99% positive. So those are the people I'm and the thing is, there are a lot of people out there who want nuance and who want realism and who want honesty in nonfiction and in fiction. I would go so far as to argue that it is a silent majority of American readers who want that, but we don't hear from them because they tend not to be hate tweeting, and they don't want to participate in that discourse. So we get the skewed notion of people being unable to read complex texts, being unable to leave their politics behind, and entertain ideas that might not be exactly their own. We get that idea because the minority who reacts that way is so loud, and they have this, they have these incredibly compelling platforms for it.
I read in the Wall Street Journal that somebody came to you with the so-called Harper's Letter. This was a kind of petition in which a lot of writers and intellectuals signed on to a letter that described an atmosphere in the country in which open dialogue is somehow constricted by, what would you say, Jonathan? You know, getting shouted down. And you decided not to sign that Harper's Letter. What was your decision based on?
Well, there was a very immediate thing, which was I was asked to sign it in June of 2020, and there was just no way it was not going to be taken as a comment on the protests following the murder of George Floyd. And I just thought it was bad timing that we were in the midst of a renewed reckoning with systemic racism in this country. And although there are, of course, well-publicized instances of people who say something seemingly innocuous and lose their job or are canceled in some fashion, which is to say the Harper's letter didn't come out of nowhere, I felt that there was just terrible timing, that we ought to honor the moment and also honor the understandable impatience and anger of Black Lives Matter. So yeah, it was kind of a no-brainer in that sense.
I'd end with a very broad question. Is this a good time to be an American writer?
Well, gosh, is this a good time to be an American writer? I think the argument that the Harper's Letter people made was that this atmosphere is having a chilling effect on young writers, that people are being encouraged to identify what they are politically and stick to the program, and that this is somehow cramping careers, young careers. I have no way to know if that's true. I actually suspect it's not. It's a weak writer who's going to knuckle under in that sense. And I would say, honestly, David, it's a much better time to be an American writer than I would have guessed 25 years ago.
Why do you say that?
Well, in the 90s, when the internet arose and was added to TV and to movies, the three screens, it seemed as if the world of letters would soon be extinct. It would be chamber music.
The attention span argument.
The attention span argument, and the fact that the new technologies really are so designed to be so addictive. So it's not just attention span, mm-hmm. but also the attention drain. And not coincidentally, I was writing at a time when my second novel hadn't sold well. And I thought, this must be the end of literature. but I really, really meant it. I really was worried.
Yeah.
And it seemed I kind of gave it 10 years. And the fact that the literary world continues to thrive and I would argue has become more inclusive in a great way. I think we're hearing from voices of all kinds, particularly people of color and non-male writers, non-cis male writers. I think there's a lot of energy there, and it's like I said, so much better than I would have guessed.
Crossroads comes out this week. It's the sixth novel by Jonathan Franzen. And you can find some of Jonathan's essays and reporting and more at newyorker.com. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Come on!
This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Get your head, jump out of bed, cause we're turning up the light. Yeah, it's time to awaken, waitress, start a bacon, Broadway's back tonight. Hey, New York, time to pop your cork, cause the future's looking bright.
The Tony Awards last weekend was quite a different event than in previous years. But a year and a half after the pandemic, Broadway is coming back, albeit with vaccination cards and masks and forehead thermometers, and of course, sanitizer by the handful. Shows that closed in March of 2020 are now reopening. New shows are having their premieres. And the Broadway season is quite unusual in another way as well. It will feature seven plays written by Black playwrights, and believe it or not, that's a record. Vincent Cunningham and Alexandra Schwartz both write about theater for The New Yorker.
Everything has changed so much. I mean, so have you been to the theater lately? You know, have you dipped a toe in yet?
I've been to several shows, a couple things off Broadway. The first Broadway thing I saw was Passover by Antoinette Nwandu. It was really, really, excited in there. People were, you know, doing their woos and claps and stuff before the curtain even came up. It was like a sort of, everybody was really excited to be back. How about you? Have you been back in the seat yet?
I've been back in the seat in kind of the lowest key way. The only thing I have seen so far, and this is all about to change, but I went to the Hunter College's theater to see What Happened, Richard Nelson's final play in his Rhinebeck panorama. And yes, you know, visceral feelings of anxiety encountering fellow human beings in a small space, and that moment when someone coughs and everyone kind of seizes up. And this theater has, I don't know exactly how many seats, but I'd be willing to say fewer than 100. And, you know, I think I cried at least three times during that play, which I might have anyway. I love Richard Nelson. Yeah. And what he was working with specifically in this play is this sense of presence, of being with other people. The play, as many of his plays do, takes place around a kitchen table. And it is about being in community with other people. That feeling was really strong. And that reminded me of what we have been missing with the theaters closed. And Vincent, you know, I'm just wondering, we're about to get back into the seats. We're about to be in and out of theaters constantly over the next few months. What strikes you about this season, looking at what's on deck?
Well, you know, but I think, and we've talked about this before, I think that there's always a tension on Broadway between things that want to be kind of serious and intellectual and literary, and things that present themselves more as entertainment. It's funny because the first thing back, and I talked about this in my review just a bit, was Passover, which was a funny thing to be a first thing back, because, you know, Broadway is back comes with these like jazz hands that makes me think about like Aladdin the musical or whatever. And instead it was this downbeat meditation on like police violence and Black alienation and lots of other themes like that. And so it did seem like a bit of an uncomfortable fit. And then, you know, on the other hand, literally Aladdin the musical is in fact back. So, you know.
Yeah, you know, I'm just looking at plays like Is This a Room, which is the whistleblower Reality Winner's arrest by the FBI, her interrogation and her arrest by the FBI, and dramatizes it without straying from the transcript that is available to us.
Okay. Is your dog friendly?
Okay, so she does not like men.
Okay, so that's a problem.
However, and she might come towards you, but she's not aggressive. She's never bitten anybody. She's just got, you know, a really good growl going. She'll probably just hide under my desk.
Okay. Do you have a leash or something where we could...
I get her leashed up.
So what we might want to do is maybe let you go...
And I'm also just glancing at the calendar right now, looking ahead. And one thing that sticks out to me is Diana, the Princess Diana musical.
Just like that, they fell in love all of where...
So the contrast between, you know, a play about the arrest of Reality Winner and a play about Princess Diana, a musical about Princess Diana, I'm very curious about how audiences will react and also who the audiences are going to be. You know, presumably you have the diehard Broadway heads who want to show up and see stuff. But I wonder, you know, if the Diana audience member is also going to be the Is This a Room audience member.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. And, you know, disproportionately, the sort of Diana the musical side of it is peopled by tourists. And who knows how they're going to show up and what their place in all this will be, what tourism numbers will continue to look like as the season winds on. But I feel, you know, fairly certain that the tourist is not going to be, you know, psyched for Reality Winner.
Are there other things you're particularly looking forward to?
Well, yeah, looking forward, I'm always excited. Well, there are two new Lynn Nottage plays that I'm looking forward to, each in its own way. One is called Clydes, which will star one of my favorite actors these days, Uzo Aduba. I've been watching a lot of the show in treatment and really enjoying her work. But then on the other hand, and who knows what that will hold. For me, new Lynn Nottage is always a good time. But the other thing, which I think also brings this entertainment thing into view, is she's doing a Michael Jackson musical, which, you know, that's there are many things that could be brought up in connection with Michael Jackson. Of course, there's a version that is not so great that elides all of these things that could happen, but I'm hoping against hope that it will reveal itself, as you mentioned, to sort of walk that thin line between art and entertainment.
Me too. That is a fascinating project. And yeah, it's sort of like, you know, it seems like gold for a jukebox musical, what's not to love about the music, but the story and the ethical reality of dealing with a figure like Michael Jackson is, you know, it's quite complex and tricky. I really wonder what we're going to get with that one.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that everybody is talking about these days, the great big capital E everybody, is the proliferation of Black written shows on Broadway. I believe that they're, seven was the number we kept on hearing. And now that Slave Play is coming back, I guess you have to call it eight. Slave Play by Jeremy O'Harris. I wonder, Alex, do you think that this means something new in the future? Do you think it solves problems or poses new ones? What does that number mean to you?
That's such a good question. You know, the ultimate answer is we're not going to know until we see the plays, because we have no idea what these plays are going to be like. You know, will they be good? Will they be middling? Will they be not great? Who knows? I think the fact of more diversity on Broadway can only be good, because Broadway is like a slow moving cruise ship. It wants to appeal to its familiar audience. Its audience is by and large older, by and large whiter than the New York mean, certainly. And I think, you know, in moments like this where the season was just wiped clean by COVID, it clearly has given producers and theaters a new opening to try some new things and to bring some new voices to Broadway. I think that's really important. I think it's really important for the ecosystem of Broadway, for the theater in general. I mean, if Broadway is just a crowd-pleasing, tried and true entertainment device, yeah, that works for some of the things we need to work for tourism, for industry, et cetera. But as a creative field, not so much. I think the concern is what often happens when, you know, underrepresented groups are brought in. You know, it reminds me of the phenomenon of like when you hire a female CEO for your company just before the company takes, you know, is this is this an honest attempt? And I really hope it is. You know, what no one wants us to be is a cynical optics attempt. And then we don't see another really diverse Broadway season for the next 30 years. I'm going in and approaching it with a lot of optimism and with just the usual curiosity I have for any new show. How about you? What are you thinking about it?
Yeah, on the level of each individual play, I feel the exact same way. It's always like, go and see what happens, right? Go and see what the play does to you. You can only bring so much sociology with you into the scene, right? But for me, the big thing is, yes, like seeing whether this is a lasting change on the side of the selection of the plays. But also, I think to the extent that it is a pressing opportunity in the now, it is how do you start to use this to be sort of, how do you use it to change what the audiences look like? How do you sort of turn Broadway, flawed as it is, into a vehicle for like small D democracy, which is like what the theater is supposed to be about.
Broadway lives and dies by who goes to see the plays. And it would be fascinating and fantastic if we could get a wider range of audience member. How amazing would it be if, in the best case scenario that I can see, is that Broadway's return to New York City a bit and to the people of New York. So that could be something very cool.
I do wonder if the movie version of Dear Evan Hansen will drive a new wave of people to that show too, which I have another thing that I have not seen. I have not been found in the seats of Evan Hansen. I'm so sorry. I'm really sorry.
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing, you know, now we're talking about all these exciting genre breaking new Broadway shows. Actually, I would like to kind of go around and see a lot of the musicals that have been around for a while that I have missed. Dear Evan Hansen is definitely at the top of my list. I haven't seen The Lion King since since I went with my parents and my younger cousin, I want to say in the year 2003. Is that possible?
That's possible, yeah.
You know, let's go see The Lion King. Would you like to go with me?
Let's go see The Lion King. Yep. Let's do
Great.
It.
Vincent Cunningham and Alexandra Schwartz are staff writers and critics for The New Yorker. Now, this week is the New Yorker Festival, our 22nd annual celebration with guests like Merrick Garland, Letitia James, Stanley Tucci, Amy Schumer, Jane Goodall, and Kara Walker. And there are live events too featuring Billie Eilish, Dave Grohl, Amy Mann, and more. You can find out more about the New Yorker Festival at newyorker.com/festival. That's newyorker.com/festival. And there's more to come today, too, on the New Yorker Radio Hour, so stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Mama!
You've been on my mind! How are you?
Tell me everything.
Well, I'm tired, but I am happy. It has been, you know, like a violent sort of reimagination of life as I know it. It's insane. I mean, parenthood is insane.
Yeah, I've heard that.
She's sleeping now. She said a quick hello earlier.
She's sleeping? What do you, a little bourbon and helps or something?
Yeah, a little whiskey in the bottle.
The other day, I caught up with our music critic, Amanda Petrusic, and I hadn't seen her in quite a while. Amanda, I feel like I'm breaking into your house. You're on leave with a new baby. We miss you in our pages and pixels, but I know it'll come again soon. And apparently you're playing music, as a good music critic should, for your baby, Nico.
I am indeed.
So give us the playlist.
It's such an overwhelming idea, I think, for any parent, but especially for a music critic who perhaps sort of fancies herself a connoisseur of sound, to say like, oh my God, it's this blank slate. Like, you've never heard anything. Like, it's as if an alien has, you know, just landed on Earth, and you get to kind of introduce them to the sort of magnitude of you know, popular music and sound. And so that's intimidating. I think at first it was like, God, I need to play things for her, you know, just the greatest recordings ever made. But I pretty quickly kind of loosened my grip on that idea and just wanted songs that we could be happy listening to together, songs that we could share, and she would be excited and I would be excited. And, you know, by the time the thing was over, we would both be really smiling and happy. It was funny. I mean, so many of the songs I've been playing her are from like the late 60s, early 70s, as if I'm raising a boomer baby. But I think that music is kind of comfort food for me. You know, it's stuff that just sounds really good and sounds really right and easy. I have to say, and I don't know, David, where you kind of are on the Lennon-McCartney spectrum, but for me, I've always thought Paul McCartney might be the kind of greatest chronicler of domestic bliss within the rock and roll canon. I mean, historically, not a very popular topic for rock songwriters. But McCartney, I think, is kind of a total savant when it comes to this particular strain of sentimentality. And so one of my favorite records from his solo career is Ram, which he and Linda released in 1971. And it's really an album, I think, about having a baby.
I know that McCartney's, you know, post-Beatles reputation's had ups and downs, but I think he's kind of proud of Ram.
I think he is, too. It's a beautiful record, and I think, you know, really captures like that sort of gooey, kind of pie-eyed, like exhausted but so in love period that follows having a baby.
Yeah.
I look high, I look low, I'm looking everywhere I go. Looking for a home in the heart of the country.
So Nico loves Heart of the Country, which is a song from Ram, which I play for her almost every morning. And it also contains the very relevant line, I'm going to get me a good night's sleep. Still a bit of a pipe dream at the moment. And it's a song, I mean, I think much of Ram has this kind of vibe, but it has an almost nursery rhyme sort of feel to it. Her whole face just lights up. She does this incredibly goofy open mouth grin. It's like, you know, it's like the sun has just risen in the sky for the first time ever. And no matter how many times I play it for her, the reaction is the same. She's just so unbelievably stoked to hear it. One thing I've learned in these first few months as a parent is that babies require a lot of rocking and jiggling and bouncing. Nico really loves to be danced around the room. And one of our favorite songs, and a song I was especially excited to play for her in those kind of giddy early days when I was so happy but so tired, is Rocksteady by Aretha Franklin. Single from Young, Gifted, and Black, a record Franklin released in 1972 that I still think is one of the greatest soul records of all time.
Rocksteady, baby, that's what I feel now. Let's call the song exactly what it is. Step and move your hips with a feeling from side to side. Sit yourself down in your car and take a ride. And while you're moving, rocksteady, rocksteady.
I think you actually cannot be tired while listening to Rocksteady, so
it would help me. It can happen.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's sort of instant caffeine. It's like a shot in the arm. I I have to say pop music is really great to sing to babies, as you know, because of just how many instances of the word baby appear in these songs. You know, she's convinced they're all about her.
What's your third pick?
So my daughter is named Nico. And in 1967, the Velvet Underground, one of my all-time favorite bands, released an album featuring a German singer, model, actress named Nico. My daughter wasn't named after her exactly, but I've always loved the name, which evokes for me a kind of deeply effortless cool. It's a quality I do not possess, but that I hope perhaps my child will one day grow into. And one of my favorite songs off the Velvet Underground and Nico is probably also one of the most sentimental things Lou Reed ever wrote. It's a track called I'll Be Your Mirror.
It's good to have a song by a complete heroin addict.
I know. When I was playing this for her early on, my husband would be like, are you sure this song isn't about heroin? The fact is, I'm not sure. But a sweet song. I think, you know, Lou, probably a softie at heart. So let me go ahead and play you a little bit. And I've always thought the first verse of this song is a pretty good encapsulation of what a parent's job is. Kind of helping someone see how magnificent they are when perhaps that idea has been obscured to them.
I'll be your mirror, reflect what you are, in case you don't know. I'll be the wind, the rain and the sunset, the light on your door, to show that you're home. When you think the night has in your mind.
It's wonderful to see you.
Yeah, likewise.
I wish for you and Nico and everyone at your house nothing but peace and good health and a good night's sleep, too.
Thank you so much, David.
Take care.
'Cause I see you.
Amanda Petrusich is a staff writer, and her last piece for us before Nico was born was a tribute to the late Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones. Amanda's new parent playlist includes Heart of the Country by Paul and Linda McCartney, Rock Steady by Aretha Franklin, and I'll Be Your Mirror from the Velvet Underground and Nico.
I find it hard to believe you don't know.
So corny. Being a parent makes you so corny. I'm embarrassing my daughter, and she's only 3 months old. It's already happening. I'm sorry, Nico. Your mom is a dork.
When you think the night is in your mind, that inside you.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
Your eyes, a hand to your darkness, so you won't be afraid. When you think the night is in your mind, that inside you twisted and unkind.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.